The Current would be remembered by history mainly because it contained the first published prose of Benjamin Franklin. And James would become known for being the harsh and jealous master described in his brother's autobiography. In fairness, however, The Current ought to be remembered on its own as America's first fiercely independent newspaper, a bold, anti-establishment journal that helped to create the nation's tradition of an irreverent press. It was the first open effort to defy the norm, literary historian Perry Miller has written. Defying authority in Boston at that time meant defying the Mathers and the role of the Puritan clergy in secular life, a cause James took up on the first page of his paper's first edition. Unfortunately, the battle he chose was over inoculation for smallpox, and he happened to pick the wrong side. Smallpox epidemics had devastated Massachusetts at regular intervals in the 90 years since its founding. A 1677 outbreak wiped out 700 people, 12% of the population. During the epidemic of 1702, during which three of his children were stricken but survived, Cotton Mather began studying the disease. A few years later, he was introduced to the practice of inoculation by his black slave, who had undergone the procedure in Africa and showed Mather his scar. Mather checked with other blacks in Boston and found that inoculation was a standard practice in parts of Africa. Just before James Franklin's Current made its debut in 1721, the HMS Seahorse arrived from the West Indies, carrying what would become a new wave of smallpox. Within months, 900 of Boston's 10,000 inhabitants would be dead. Mather, trained as a physician before becoming a preacher, sent a letter to the 10 practicing doctors in Boston, only one of whom had a medical degree, summarizing his knowledge of the African inoculation and urging that they adopt the practice. Mather had evolved quite far from the superstitions that had led him to support Salem's witch hunts. Most of the doctors rejected the notion, and, with little justification other than a desire to prick at the pretensions of the preachers, so did James Franklin's new newspaper. The first issue of The Current, August 7, 1721, contained an essay by a young friend of James's, John Checkley, a sassy, Oxford-educated Anglican. He singled out for his sally the Puritan clergy, who, by teaching and practicing what's orthodox, pray hard against sickness, yet preach up the pox. The issue also carried a diatribe by the town's only physician who actually had a medical degree, Dr. William Douglas, who dismissed inoculation as the practice of Greek old women, and called Mather and his fellow ministerial proponents six gentlemen of piety and learning profoundly ignorant of the matter. It was the first example, and a robust one at that, of a newspaper attacking the ruling establishment in America. Increase Mather, the family's aging patriarch, thundered, "I cannot but pity poor Franklin, who, though but a young man, it may be speedily he must appear before the judgment seat of God." Cotton Mather, his son, wrote a letter to a rival paper denouncing the notorious scandalous paper called The Current, full freighted with nonsense, unmanliness, raillery, and comparing its contributors to the Hellfire Club, a well-known clique of dapper young heretics in London. Cotton's cousin, a preacher named Thomas Walter, weighed in by writing a scathing piece entitled The Anti-Current. Knowing full well that this public spat would sell papers, and eager to profit from both sides of an argument, James Franklin quite happily took on the job of publishing and selling Thomas Walter's rebuttal. However, the escalating personal nature of the controversy began to unsettle him. After a few weeks, he announced in an editor's note that he had banned Checkley from his paper for letting the feud get too vindictive. Henceforth, he promised, the Current would aim to be innocently diverting and would publish opinions on either side of the inoculation controversy as long as they were free from malicious reflections. Benjamin Franklin managed to stay out of his brother's smallpox battle with the Mather family, and he never mentioned it in his autobiography or letters, a striking omission that suggests that he was not proud of the side the paper chose. He later became a fervent advocate of inoculation, painfully and poignantly espousing the cause right after his four-year-old son Francis died of the pox in 1736. And he would, both as an aspiring boy of letters and as a striver who sought the patronage of influential elders, end up becoming Cotton Mather's admirer and, a few years later, his acquaintance. Books. The print trade was a natural calling for Franklin. "From a child I was fond of reading," he recalled, "and all the little money that came into my hands was ever laid out in books." Indeed, books were the most important formative influence in his life, and he was lucky to grow up in Boston, where libraries had been carefully nurtured since the Arabella brought 50 volumes along with the town's first settlers in 1630. By the time Franklin was born, Cotton Mather had built a private library of almost 3,000 volumes, rich in classical and scientific as well as theological works. This appreciation of books was one of the traits shared by the Puritanism of Mather and the Enlightenment of Locke, worlds that would combine in the character of Benjamin Franklin. Less than a mile from Mather's library was the small bookshelf of Josiah Franklin. Though certainly modest, it was still notable that an uneducated Chandler would have one at all. 50 years later, Franklin could still recall its titles. Plutarch's Lives, which I read abundantly, Daniel Defoe's An Essay Upon Projects, Cotton Mather's Bonifacius, Essays to Do Good, and an assortment of Books in Polemic Divinity. Once he began working in his brother's print shop, Franklin was able to sneak books from the apprentices who worked for booksellers as long as he returned the volumes clean. "Often I sat up in my room reading the greatest part of the night when the book was borrowed in the evening and to be returned early in the morning, lest it should be missed or wanted." Franklin's favorite books were about voyages, spiritual as well as terrestrial, and the most notable of these was about both. John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, the saga of the tenacious quest by a man named Christian to reach the Celestial City, which was published in 1678 and quickly became popular among Puritans and other dissenters. As important as its religious message, at least for Franklin, was the refreshingly clean and sparse prose style it offered in an age when writing had become clotted by the richness of the Restoration. "Honest John was the first that I know of," Franklin correctly noted, "who mixed narration and dialogue, a method of writing very engaging to the reader." A central theme of Bunyan's book, and of the passage from Puritanism to Enlightenment and of Franklin's life, was contained in its title, Progress, the concept that individuals, and humanity in general move forward and improve based on a steady increase of knowledge and the wisdom that comes from conquering adversity. Christian's famous opening phrase sets the tone. As I walk through the wilderness of this world, even for the faithful, this progress was not solely the handiwork of the Lord, but also the result of a human struggle by individuals and communities to triumph over obstacles. Likewise, another Franklin favorite, and one must pause to marvel at a 12-year-old with such tastes in leisure pursuits, was Plutarch's Lives, which is also based on the premise that individual endeavor can change the course of history for the better. Plutarch's heroes, like Bunyan's Christian, are honorable men who believe that their personal strivings are intertwined with the progress of humanity. History is a tale, Franklin came to believe, not of immutable forces, but of human endeavors. This outlook clashed with some of the tenets of Calvinism, such as the essential depravity of man and the predestination of his soul, which Franklin would eventually abandon as he edged his way closer to the less daunting deism that became the creed of choice during the Enlightenment. Yet there were many aspects of Puritanism that made a lasting impression. Most notably, the practical, sociable, community-oriented aspects of that religion. These were expressed eloquently in a work that Franklin often cited as a key influence, Bonifacius, Essays to Do Good, one of the few gentle tracts of the more than 400 written by Cotton Mather. If I have been, Franklin wrote to Cotton Mather's son almost 70 years later, a useful citizen, the public owes the advantage of it to that book. Franklin's first pen name, Silence Do Good, paid homage both to the book and to a famous sermon by Mather, Silentiarius, The Silent Sufferer. Mather's tract called on members of the community to form voluntary associations to benefit society, and he personally founded a neighborhood improvement group known as Associated Families, which Benjamin's father joined. He also urged the creation of young men associated clubs and of reforming societies for the suppression of disorders, which would seek to improve local laws, provide charity for the poor, and encourage religious behavior. Mather's ideas were influenced by Daniel Defoe's An Essay Upon Projects, which was another favorite book of Franklin's. Published in 1697, it proposed for London many of the sort of community projects that Franklin would later launch in Philadelphia. Fire insurance associations, voluntary seamen's societies to create pensions, schemes to provide welfare for the elderly and widows, academies to educate the children of the middle class, and, with just a touch of Defoe humor, institutions to house the mentally retarded, paid for by a tax on authors, because they happened to get a greater share of intelligence at birth, just as the retarded happened to get less. Among Defoe's most progressive notions was that it was barbarous and inhumane to deny women equal education and rights. And An Essay Upon Projects contains a diatribe against such sexism. Around that time, Franklin and another bookish lad named John Collins began engaging each other in debates as an intellectual sport. Their first topic was the education of women, with Collins opposing it. "I took the contrary side," Franklin recalled, not totally out of conviction, but perhaps a little for dispute's sake. As a result of his mock debates with Collins, Franklin began to tailor for himself a persona that was less contentious and confrontational, which made him seem endearing and charming as he grew older, or, to a small but vocal cadre of enemies, manipulative and conniving. Being disputatious, he concluded, was a very bad habit, because contradicting people produced disgusts and perhaps enmities. Later in his life, he would wryly say of disputing, "Persons of good sense, I have since observed, seldom fall into it, except lawyers, university men, and men of all sorts that have been bred at Edinburgh." Instead, after stumbling across some rhetoric books that extolled Socrates' method of building an argument through gentle queries, he dropped my abrupt contradiction style of argument and put on the humbler inquirer of the Socratic method. By asking what seemed to be innocent questions, Franklin would draw people into making concessions that would gradually prove whatever point he was trying to assert. "I found this method the safest for myself and very embarrassing to those against whom I used it. Therefore, I took a delight in it." Although he later abandoned the more annoying aspects of a Socratic approach, he continued to favor gentle indirection rather than confrontation in making his arguments. Silence, do good. Part of his debate with Collins over the education of women was waged by exchanging letters, and his father happened to read them. Though Josiah did not take sides in the dispute, he achieved his own semblance of fairness by providing little formal education to any of his children of either sex, he did criticize his son for his weak and unpersuasive writing style. In reaction, the precocious young teen devised for himself a self-improvement course with the help of a volume of The Spectator that he found. The Spectator, a London daily that flourished in 1711 and 1712, featured deft essays by Joseph Addison and Richard Steele, probing the vanities and values of contemporary life. The outlook was humanistic and enlightened, yet light. As Addison put it, "I shall endeavor to enliven morality with wit, and to temper wit with morality." As part of his self-improvement course, Franklin read the essays, took brief notes, and laid them aside for a few days. Then he tried to recreate the essay in his own words, after which he compared his composition to the original. Sometimes he would jumble up the notes he took, so that he would have to figure out on his own the best order to build the essay's argument. He turned some of the essays into poetry, which helped him, so he thought, expand his vocabulary by forcing him to search for words that had similar meanings but different rhythms and sounds. These, too, he turned back into essays after a few days, comparing them to see where he had diverged from the original. When he found his own version wanting, he would correct it. "But I sometimes had the pleasure of fancying that in certain particulars of small import I had been lucky enough to improve the method or the language, and this encouraged me to think that I might possibly in time come to be a tolerable English writer, of which I was extremely ambitious." More than making himself merely tolerable as a writer, he became the most popular writer in colonial America. His self-taught style, as befitting a protege of Addison and Steele, featured a fun and conversational prose that was lacking in poetic flourish, but powerful in its directness. Thus was born Silence, Do Good. James Franklin's Current, which was modeled on The Spectator, featured sassy, pseudonymous essays. and his print shop attracted a congregation of clever young contributors who liked to hang around and praise each other's prose. Benjamin was eager to become part of the crowd, but he knew that James, already jealous of his upstart young brother, was unlikely to encourage him. Hearing their conversations and their accounts of the approbation their papers were received with, I was excited to try my hand among them. So one night, Franklin, disguising his handwriting, wrote an essay and slipped it under the printing house door. The cadre of current hearers who gathered the next day lauded the anonymous submission, and Franklin had the exquisite pleasure of listening as they decided to feature it on the front page of the issue out the next Monday, April 2nd, 1722. The literary character Franklin invented was a triumph of imagination. Silence Do-Good was a slightly prudish, widowed woman from a rural area, created by a spunky, unmarried Boston teenager who had never spent a night outside of the city. Despite the uneven quality of the essays, Franklin's ability to speak convincingly as a woman was remarkable, and it showed both his creativity and his appreciation for the female mind. The echoes of Addison are apparent from the outset. In Addison's first Spectator essay, he wrote, "I have observed that a reader seldom peruses a book with pleasure till he knows whether the writer of it be a black or a fair man, of a mild or choleric disposition, married or a bachelor." Franklin likewise began by justifying an autobiographical introduction from his fictitious narrator. "It is observed that the generality of people nowadays are unwilling either to commend or dispraise what they read until they are in some measure informed who or what the author of it is, whether he be poor or rich, old or young, a scholar or a leather apron man." One reason the Silence Do-Good essays are so historically notable is that they were among the first examples of what would become a quintessential American genre of humor. The wry, homespun mix of folksy tales and pointed observations that was perfected by such Franklin descendants as Mark Twain and Will Rogers. For example, in the second of the essays, Silence Do-Good tells how the minister to whom she was apprenticed decided to make her his wife. Having made several unsuccessful, fruitless attempts on the more topping sort of our sex, and being tired with making troublesome journeys and visits to no purpose, he began unexpectedly to cast a loving eye upon me. There is certainly scarce any part of a man's life in which he appears more silly and ridiculous than when he makes his first onset in courtship. Franklin's portrayal of Mrs. Do-Good exhibits a literary dexterity that was quite subtle for a 16-year-old boy. "I could easily be persuaded to marry again," he had her declare. "I am courteous and affable, good-humored, unless I am first provoked, and handsome and sometimes witty." The flick of the word "sometimes" is particularly deft. In describing her beliefs and biases, Franklin had Mrs. Do-Good assert an attitude that would, with his encouragement, become part of the emerging American character. "I am a mortal enemy to arbitrary government and unlimited power. I am naturally very jealous for the rights and liberties of my country, and the least appearance of an encroachment on those invaluable privileges is apt to make my blood boil exceedingly. I have likewise a natural inclination to observe and reprove the faults of others, at which I have an excellent faculty." It was as good a description of the real Benjamin Franklin and indeed of a typical American, as is likely to be found anywhere. Of the 14 do-good essays that Franklin wrote between April and October 1722, the one that stands out both as journalism and self-revelation is his attack on the college he never got to attend. Most of the classmates he had bested at Boston Latin had just entered Harvard, and Franklin could not refrain from lampooning them and their institution. The form he used was an allegorical narrative cast as a dream. In doing so, he drew on, and perhaps was mildly parodying, Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, also an allegorical journey set as a dream. Addison had used the form somewhat clumsily in an issue of The Spectator that Franklin read, which recounted the dream of a banker about an allegorical virgin named Public Credit. In the essay, Mrs. Duguid recounts falling asleep under an apple tree while she mulls over whether to send her son to Harvard. As she journeys in her dream toward this temple of learning, she makes a discovery about those who send sons there. Most of them consulted their own purses instead of their children's capacities, so that I observed a great many, yea, the most part of those who were traveling thither, were little better than dunces and blockheads. The gate of the temple, she finds, is guarded by two sturdy porters named Riches and Poverty, and only those who meet the approval of the former could get in. Most of the students are content to dally with the figures called Idleness and Ignorance. They learn little more than how to carry themselves handsomely and enter a room genteelly, which might as well be acquired at a dancing school, and from thence they return, after abundance of trouble and charge, as great blockheads as ever, only more proud and self-conceited. Picking up on the proposals of Mather and Defoe for voluntary civic associations, Franklin devoted two of his Silence Duguid essays to the topic of relief for single women. For widows like herself, Mrs. Duguid proposes an insurance scheme funded by subscriptions from married couples. The next essay extended the idea to spinsters. A friendly society would be formed that would guarantee £500 in ready cash to any member who reaches age 30 and is still not married. The money, Mrs. Duguid notes, would come with a condition. No woman who, after claiming and receiving, has had the good fortune to marry, shall entertain any company by praising her husband above the space of 1 hour at a time, upon pain of returning one half the money into the office for the first offense, and upon the second offense to return the remainder. In these essays, Franklin was being gently satirical rather than fully serious. But his interest in civic associations would later find more earnest expression, as we shall see, when he became established as a young tradesman in Philadelphia. Franklin's vanity was further fed during that summer of 1722, when his brother was jailed for 3 weeks, without trial, by Massachusetts authorities for the high affront of questioning their competence in pursuing pirates. For 3 issues, Benjamin got to put out the paper. He boasts in his autobiography that, "I had the management of the paper, and I made bold to give our rulers some rubs in it, which my brother took very kindly, while others began to consider me in an unfavorable light as a young genius that had a turn for libeling and satire." In fact, other than a letter to the readers written from prison by James, nothing in Benjamin's 3 issues directly challenged the civil authorities. The closest he came was having Mrs. Duguid quote in full an essay from an English newspaper that defended free speech. "Without freedom of thought, there can be no such thing as wisdom," it declared, "and no such thing as public liberty without freedom of speech." The rubs that Franklin remembered came a week after his brother's return from prison. Writing as Silence Duguid, he unleashed a piercing attack on the civil authorities, perhaps the most biting of his entire career. The question that Mrs. Duguid posed was whether a commonwealth suffers more by hypocritical pretenders to religion or by the openly profane. Unsurprisingly, Franklin's Mrs. Duguid argued that some late thoughts of this nature have inclined me to think that the hypocrite is the most dangerous person of the two, especially if he sustains a post in the government. The piece attacked the link between the church and the state, which was the very foundation of the Puritan Commonwealth. Governor Thomas Dudley, who moved from the ministry to the law, is cited, though not by name, as an example. "The most dangerous hypocrite in a commonwealth is one who leaves the gospel for the sake of the law. A man compounded of law and gospel is able to cheat a whole country with his religion and then destroy them under color of law." By the fall of 1722, Franklin was running short of ideas for Silence Duguid. Worse yet, his brother was beginning to suspect the provenance of the pieces. In her 13th submission, Silence Duguid noted that she had overheard a conversation one night in which a gentleman had said, "Though I wrote in the character of a woman, he knew me to be a man. But," continued he "has more need of endeavoring a reformation in himself than spending his wit in satirizing others." The next Duguid would be Franklin's last. When he revealed Mrs. Duguid's true identity, it raised his stature among the currenteers, but did not quite please James. He thought, probably with reason, that it tended to make me too vain. Silence Duguid had been able to get away with an attack on hypocrisy and religion. But when James penned a similar piece in January 1723, he landed in trouble yet again. "Of all knaves," he wrote, "the religious knave is the worst." Religion was important, he wrote, but, using words that would describe the lifelong attitude of his younger brother, he added, "Too much of it is worse than none at all." The local authorities, noting that the tendency of the said paper is to mock religion, promptly passed a resolution that required James to submit each issue to the authorities for approval before publication. James defied the order with relish. The general court responded by forbidding James Franklin from publishing the current. At a secret meeting in his shop, it was decided that the best way around the order was to continue to print the paper, but without James as its publisher. On Monday, February 11th, 1723, there appeared atop the current the masthead, "Printed and Sold by Benjamin Franklin." Benjamin's current was more cautious than that of his brother. An editorial in his first issue denounced publications that were hateful and malicious, and it declared that henceforth the current would be designed purely for the diversion and merriment of the reader, and to entertain the town with the most comical and diverting incidents of human life. The master of the paper, the editorial declared, would be the Roman god Janus, who could look two ways at once. The next few issues, however, hardly lived up to that billing. Most articles were slightly stale dispatches containing foreign news or old speeches. There was only one essay that was clearly written by Franklin. A wry musing on the folly of titles such as Viscount and Master. His aversion to hereditary and aristocratic titles would be a theme throughout his life. After a few weeks, James returned to the helm of the Current, in fact, if not officially, and he resumed treating Benjamin as an apprentice, subject to occasional beatings, rather than as a brother and fellow writer. "Such treatment demeaned me too much," Franklin recalled, and he became eager to move on. He had an urge for independence that he would help to make a hallmark of the American character. The Runaway. Franklin managed his escape by taking advantage of a ruse his brother had contrived. When James had pretended to turn over the Current to Benjamin, he signed an official discharge of his apprenticeship to make the transfer seem legitimate. But he then made Benjamin sign a new apprentice agreement that would be kept secret. A few months later, Benjamin decided to run away. He assumed correctly that his brother would realize that it was unwise to try to enforce the secret indenture. Benjamin Franklin left behind a brother whose paper would slowly fail, and whose reputation would eventually be reduced to a tarnished historical footnote. James was doomed by his brother's sharp pen to be remembered for the blows his passion too often urged him to bestow upon me. Indeed, his significance in Franklin's life is described in a brusque footnote in the autobiography, written during Franklin's time as a colonial agent fighting British rule. "I fancy his harsh and tyrannical treatment of me might be a means of impressing me with that aversion to arbitrary power that has stuck to me through my whole life." James deserved better. If Franklin learned an aversion to arbitrary power from him, it was not merely because of his alleged tyrannical style, but because he had set an example by challenging, with bravery and spunk, Boston's ruling elite. James was the first great fighter for an independent press in America, and he was the most important journalistic influence on his younger brother. He was also an important literary influence. Silence Do Good may have been, in Benjamin's mind, modeled on Addison and Steele, but in fact she more closely resembled, in her down-home vernacular and common-touch perceptions, Abigail Afterwit, Jack Dullman, and the other pseudonymous characters that had been created for the Current by James. Benjamin's break with his brother was fortunate for his career. As great as it was to be raised in Boston, it would likely have become a constricting town for a free-spirited deist who had not attended Harvard. "I had already made myself a little obnoxious to the governing party," he later wrote, "and it was likely I might, if I stayed, soon bring myself into scrapes." His mockery of religion meant that he was pointed to on the streets with horror by good people as an infidel or atheist. All in all, it was a good time for him to leave both his brother and Boston behind. It was a tradition among American pioneers, when their communities became too confining, to strike out for the frontier. But Franklin was a different type of American rebel. The wilderness did not beckon. Instead, he was enticed by the new commercial centers, New York and Philadelphia, that offered the chance to become a self-made success. John Winthrop may have led his Puritan band on an errand into the wilderness, Franklin, on the other hand, was part of a new breed leading an errand into the market streets. Afraid that his brother would try to detain him, Franklin had a friend secretly book him passage on a sloop for New York, using the cover story that it was for a boy who needed to sneak away because he had an intrigue with a girl of bad character, or, as Franklin put it in an earlier draft, had got a naughty girl with child. Selling some of his books to pay for the fare, the 17-year-old Franklin set sail in a fair wind on the evening of Wednesday, September 25th, 1723. The following Monday, the New England Courant carried a succinct, slightly sad little ad. James Franklin, printer in Queen Street, wants a likely lad for an apprentice. Chapter 3. Journeyman. Philadelphia and London, 1723 through 1726. Keimer's Shop. As a young apprentice, Franklin had read a book extolling vegetarianism. He embraced the diet, but not just for moral and health reasons. His main motive was financial. It enabled him to take the money his brother allotted him for food and save half for books. While his co-workers went off for hearty meals, Franklin ate biscuits and raisins and used the time for study, in which I made the greater progress from that greater clearness of head and quicker apprehension which usually attend temperance in eating and drinking. But Franklin was a reasonable soul, so wedded to being rational that he became adroit at rationalizing. During his voyage from Boston to New York, when his boat lay becalmed off Block Island, the crew caught and cooked some cod. Franklin at first refused any, until the aroma from the frying pan became too enticing. With droll self-awareness, he later recalled what happened. "I balanced some time between principle and inclination, until I recollected that when the fish were opened, I saw smaller fish taken out of their stomachs. Then, thought I, if you eat one another, I don't see why we may not eat you. So I dined upon cod very heartily, and have since continued to eat as other people, returning only now and then occasionally to a vegetable diet." From this he drew a wry, perhaps even a bit cynical, lesson that he expressed as a maxim. "So convenient a thing it is to be a reasonable creature, since it enables one to find or make a reason for everything one has a mind to do." Franklin's rationalism would make him an exemplar of the Enlightenment, the age of reason that flourished in 18th-century Europe and America. He had little use for the fervor of the religious age into which he was born, nor for the sublime sentiments of the Romantic period that began budding near the end of his life. But, like Voltaire, he was able to poke fun at his own efforts, and that of humanity in general, to be guided by reason. A recurring theme in his autobiography, as well as in his tales and almanacs, was his amusement at man's ability to rationalize what was convenient. At 17, Franklin was physically striking. Muscular, barrel-chested, open-faced, and almost 6 feet tall. He had the happy talent of being at ease in almost any company, from scrappy tradesmen to wealthy merchants, scholars to rogues. His most notable trait was a personal magnetism. He attracted people who wanted to help him. Never shy, and always eager to win friends and patrons, he gregariously exploited this charm. On his runaway journey, for example, he met the sole printer in New York, William Bradford, who had published editorials supporting James Franklin's fight against the oppressors and bigots in Boston. Bradford had no job to offer, but he suggested that the young runaway continue on to Philadelphia and seek work with his son Andrew Bradford, who ran the family print shop and weekly newspaper there. Franklin arrived at Philadelphia's Market Street Wharf on a Sunday morning, 10 days after his departure from Boston. In his pocket he had nothing more than a Dutch dollar and about a shilling in copper, the latter of which he gave to the boatman to pay for his passage. They tried to decline it because Franklin had helped with the rowing, but he insisted. He also gave away 2 of the 3 puffy rolls he bought to a mother and child he had met on the journey. A man is sometimes more generous when he has little money than when he has plenty, he later wrote, perhaps through fear of being thought to have but little. From his first moments in Philadelphia, Franklin cared about such appearances. American individualists sometimes boast of not worrying about what others think of them. Franklin, more typically, nurtured his reputation as a matter of both pride and utility, and he became the country's first unabashed public relations expert. I took care not only to be in reality industrious and frugal, he later wrote, but to avoid all appearances of the contrary. Especially in his early years as a young tradesman, he was, in the words of the critic Jonathan Yardley, a self-created and self-willed man who moved through life at a calculated pace toward calculated ends. With a population of 2,000, Philadelphia was then America's second largest village after Boston. Envisaged by William Penn as a green country town, it featured a well-planned grid of wide streets lined with brick houses. In addition to the original Quakers who had settled there 50 years earlier, the city, named for brotherly love, had attracted raucous and entrepreneurial German, Scotch, and Irish immigrants who turned it into a lively marketplace filled with shops and taverns. Though its economy was sputtering, and most of its streets were dirty and unpaved, the tone set by both the Quakers and subsequent immigrants was appealing to Franklin. They tended to be diligent, unpretentious, friendly, and tolerant, especially compared to the Puritans of Boston. The morning after his arrival, rested and better dressed, Franklin called on Andrew Bradford's shop. There he found not only the young printer, but also his father, William, who had come from New York on horseback and made it there faster. Andrew had no immediate work for the runaway, so William brought him around to see the town's other printer, Samuel Keimer, a testament both to Franklin's charming ability to enlist patrons and to the peculiar admixture of cooperation and competition so often found among American tradesmen. Keimer was a disheveled and quirky man with a motley printing operation. He asked Franklin a few questions, gave him a composing stick to assess his skills, and then promised to employ him as soon as he had more work. Not knowing that William was the father of his competitor, Keimer volubly described his plans for luring away most of Andrew Bradford's business. Franklin stood by silently, marveling at the elder Bradford's craftiness. After Bradford left, Franklin recalled, Keimer was greatly surprised when I told him who the old man was. Even after this inauspicious introduction, Franklin was able to get work from Keimer while he lodged with the younger Bradford. When Keimer finally insisted that he find living quarters that were less of a professional conflict, he fortuitously was able to rent a room from John Reed, the father of the young girl who had been so amused by his appearance the day he straggled off the boat. My chest and clothes being come by this time, I made rather a more respectable appearance in the eyes of Miss Reed than I had done when she first happened to see me eating my roll in the street, he noted. Franklin thought Keimer an odd fish, but he enjoyed having sport with him as they shared their love for philosophical debate. Franklin honed the Socratic method he found so useful for winning arguments without antagonizing opponents. He would ask Keimer questions that seemed innocent and tangential, but eventually exposed his logical fallacies. Keimer, who was prone to embracing eclectic religious beliefs, was so impressed that he proposed they establish a sect together. Keimer would be in charge of the doctrines, such as not trimming one's beard, and Franklin would be in charge of defending them. Franklin agreed with one condition, that vegetarianism be part of the creed. The experiment ended after 3 months, when Keimer, ravenous, gave in to temptation and ate an entire roast pig by himself one evening. Franklin's magnetism attracted not only patrons, but also friends. With his clever mind, disarming wit and winning smile, he became a popular member of the town's coterie of young tradesmen. His clique included 3 young clerks, Charles Osborne, Joseph Watson, and James Ralph. Ralph was the most literary of the group, a poet convinced both of his own talent and of the need to be self-indulgent in order to be a great artist. Osborne, a critical lad, was jealous and invariably belittled Ralph's efforts. On one of their long walks by the river during which the 4 friends read their work to one another, Ralph had a poem he knew Osborne would criticize. So he got Franklin to read the poem as if it were his own. Osborne, falling for the ruse, heaped praise on it, teaching Franklin a rule of human nature that served him well with a few exceptions throughout his career. People are more likely to admire your work if you're able to keep them from feeling jealous of you. An unreliable patron. The most fateful patron Franklin befriended was Pennsylvania's effusive governor, Sir William Keith, a well-meaning but feckless busybody. They met as a result of a passionate letter Franklin had written to a brother-in-law, explaining why he was happy in Philadelphia and had no desire to return to Boston or let his parents know where he was. The relative showed the letter to Governor Keith, who expressed surprise that a missive so eloquent had been written by a lad so young. The governor, who realized that both of the established printers in his province were wretched, decided to seek out Franklin and encourage him. When Governor Keith, dressed in all his finery, marched up the street to Keimer's print shop, the disheveled owner bustled out to greet him. To his surprise, Keith asked to see Franklin, whom he proceeded to lavish with compliments and an invitation to join him for a drink. Keimer, Franklin later noted, stared like a pig poisoned. Over fine Madeira at a nearby tavern, Governor Keith offered to help Franklin set up on his own. He would use his influence, Keith promised, to get him the province's official business, and would write Franklin's father a letter exhorting him to help finance his son. Keith followed up with invitations to dinner, further flattery, and continued encouragement. So, with a fulsome letter from Keith in hand, and dreams of a familial reconciliation followed by fame and fortune, Franklin was ready to face his family again. He boarded a ship heading for Boston in April 1724. It had been 7 months since he had run away, and his parents were not even sure that he was still alive, so they were thrilled by his return and welcomed him warmly. Franklin had not, however, yet learned his lesson about the pitfalls of pride and of provoking jealousy. He sauntered down to the print shop of his jilted brother James, proudly sporting a genteel new suit, a fancy watch, and 5 pounds of silver coins bulging his pocket. James looked him up and down, turned on his heels, and silently went back to work. Franklin could not refrain from flaunting his new status. As James stewed, he regaled the shop's young journeyman with tales of his happy life in Philadelphia, spread his silver coins on the table for them to admire, and gave them money to buy drinks. James later told their mother he could never forget nor forgive the offense. "In this, however, he was mistaken," Franklin recalled. His family's old antagonist, Cotton Mather, was more receptive and instructive. He invited young Franklin over, chatted with him in his magnificent library, and let it be known that he forgave him for the barbs that had appeared in the Current. As they were making their way out, they went through a narrow passage, and Mather suddenly warned, "Stoop! Stoop!" Franklin, not understanding the exhortation, bumped his head on a low beam. As was his wont, Mather turned it into a homily. "Let this be a caution to you not always to hold your head so high. Stoop, young man, stoop as you go through this world, and you'll miss many hard thumps." As Franklin later recalled to Mather's son, "This advice, thus beat into my head, has frequently been of use to me, and I often think of it when I see pride mortified and misfortunes brought upon people by carrying their heads too high." Although the lesson was a useful counterpoint to his showy visit to his brother's print shop, he failed to include it in his autobiography. Governor Keith's letter and proposal surprised Josiah Franklin. But after considering it for a few days, he decided it was imprudent to fund a rather rebellious runaway who was only 18. Though he was proud of the patronage his son had attracted and the industriousness he had shown, Josiah knew that Benjamin was still impudent. Seeing no chance of a reconciliation between his two sons, Josiah did give his blessing for Benjamin to return to Philadelphia, with the exhortation to behave respectfully to the people there and avoid lampooning and libeling, to which he thought I had too much inclination. If he was able, by steady industry and prudent parsimony, to save almost enough to open his own shop by the time he was 21, Josiah promised he would help fund the rest. Franklin's old friend John Collins, entranced by his tales, decided to leave Boston as well. But once in Philadelphia, the two teenagers had a falling out. Collins, academically brighter than Franklin but less disciplined, soon took to drink. He borrowed money from Franklin and began to resent him. One day, when they were boating with friends on the Delaware, Collins refused to row his turn. Others in the boat were willing to let it pass, but not Franklin, who scuffled with him, grabbed him by the crotch, and threw him overboard. Each time Collins swam up to the boat, Franklin and the others would row it away a few feet more while insisting that he promised to take his turn at the oars. Proud and resentful, Collins never agreed, but they finally allowed him back in. He and Franklin barely spoke after that, and Collins ended up going to Barbados, never repaying the money he had borrowed. In the course of a few months, Franklin had learned from four people, James Ralph, James Franklin, Cotton Mather, and John Collins, lessons about rivalry and resentments, pride and modesty. Throughout his life, he would occasionally make enemies, such as the Penn family, and jealous rivals, such as John Adams. But he did so less than most men, especially men so accomplished. A secret to being more revered than resented, he learned, was to display, at least when he could muster the discipline, a self-deprecating humor, unpretentious demeanor, and unaggressive style in conversation. Josiah Franklin's refusal to fund his son's printing venture did not dampen Governor Keith's enthusiasm.
"Since he will not set you up, I will do it myself," he grandly promised. "I am resolved to have a good printer here."
He asked Franklin for a list of what equipment was necessary. Franklin estimated it would cost about £100, and then suggested that Franklin should sail to London so that he could personally pick out the fonts and make contacts. Keith pledged letters of credit to pay for both the equipment and the voyage. The adventurous Franklin was thrilled. In the months leading up to his planned departure, he dined frequently with the governor. Whenever he asked for the promised letters of credit, they were not ready, but Franklin felt no reason to worry. At the time, Franklin was courting his landlady's daughter, Deborah Reed. Despite his sexual appetites, he was practical about what he wanted in a wife. Deborah was rather plain, but she offered the prospect of comfort and domesticity. Franklin offered a lot as well, in addition to his husky good looks and genial charm. He had transformed himself from the bedraggled runaway she first spotted wandering up Market Street into one of the town's most promising and eligible young tradesmen, one who had found favor with the governor and popularity with his peers. Deborah's father had recently died, which put her mother into financial difficulty and made her open to the prospect of a good marriage for her daughter. Nevertheless, she was wary of allowing her to marry a suitor who was preparing to leave for London. She insisted that marriage wait until he returned. London. In November 1724, just over a year after arriving in Philadelphia, Franklin set sail for London. Traveling with him was the boy who had replaced Collins as his unreliable best friend, the aspiring poet James Ralph, who was leaving behind a wife and child. Franklin still had not received the letters of credit from Governor Keith, but he was assured that they would be sent on board in the final bag of dispatches. Only after he arrived in London, on Christmas Eve, did Franklin discover the truth. The flighty governor had supplied no letters of credit nor recommendation. Franklin, puzzled, consulted a fellow passenger named Thomas Denham, a prominent Quaker merchant who had befriended him on the voyage. Denham explained to Franklin that Keith was incorrigibly capricious, and he laughed at the idea of the governor's giving me a letter of credit, having, as he said, no credit to give. For Franklin, it was an insight into human foibles rather than evil. He wished to please everybody, Franklin later said of Keith, and having little to give, he gave expectations. Taking Denham's advice, Franklin decided to make the best of his situation. London was enjoying a golden age of peace and prosperity, one particularly appealing to an intellectually ambitious young printer. Among those then brightening the world of London letters were Swift, Defoe, Pope, Richardson, Fielding, and Chesterfield. With the dreamy wastrel Ralph under his wing, Franklin found cheap lodgings and a job at a famous printing house, Samuel Palmer's. Ralph tried to get work as an actor, then as a journalist or clerk. He failed on all fronts, borrowing money from Franklin all the while. It was an odd couple symbiosis of the type often found between ambitious, practical guys and their carefree romantic pals. Franklin diligently made the money. Ralph made sure they spent it all on the theater and other amusements, including occasional intrigues with low women. Ralph quickly forgot his own wife and child in Philadelphia, and Franklin followed suit by ignoring his engagement to Deborah and writing her only once. The friendship exploded, not surprisingly, over a woman. Ralph fell in love with a pleasant but poor young milliner, moved in with her, then was finally motivated to find work as a teacher in a village school in Berkshire. He wrote Franklin often, sending installments of a bad epic poem, along with requests that Franklin look after his girlfriend. That he did, all too well. He lent her money, comforted her loneliness, and then, being at the time under no religious restraint, tried to seduce her. Ralph returned in a fury, broke off their friendship, and declared that the transgression released him from the duty of paying back any debts, which amounted to £27. Franklin later concluded that the loss of the money he was owed was balanced by the loss of the burden of having Ralph as a friend. A pattern was emerging. Beginning with Collins and Ralph, Franklin easily made casual friends, intellectual companions, useful patrons, flirty admirers, and circles of genial acquaintances. But he was less good at nurturing lasting bonds that involved deep personal commitments or emotional relationships, even within his own family.